report last year by the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service, CSIS, indicated a central problem in understanding Islamist terrorists. They believe it is both moral and a means to fulfill a religious obligation to commit a terrorist act, and that the highest morality is martyrdom. Likewise, in his book about a 19-year-old Canadian, Mohammed Mansour Jabara, Sammy to his friends, Stuart Bell noted, for a terrorist to confess is not to admit to sins. It's the opposite, to say proudly before God that he's not only a believer, but one who has acted on his faith. Sammy had pledged bayat, personal allegiance to bin Laden, in the summer of 2001, following his training at the Al-Farouq camp near Kandahar. And Kandahar, incidentally, today is a theater of operations for the 3rd Battalion, Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry, on its second deployment to Afghanistan. They are conducting what both U.S. and Canadian forces call three-block war. Bell's book deals with a significant new phenomenon, the recruitment of terrorists from a domestic population. In addition, both he and CSIS are puzzled by the terrorist attitudes, that acts of violence are, quote, moral, and that martyrdom, even including the suicide of the alleged martyr, is the highest morality. Both of these matters carry implications that extend far beyond the borders of North America. There are a number of terminological problems to be sorted out in order to make sense of contemporary terrorists. Several terms are available to describe the beliefs of the terrorists against whom we are fighting: Islamist, jihadist, Islamic fundamentalist, radical Islam, Salafist, and so on. I prefer the term militant Salafist because it has an intelligible intellectual pedigree that can be traced back to a distinctive and highly dogmatic 13th century school of Sharia interpretation developed by Ibn Taymiyyah, who was himself a member of the already strict Hanbali sect of Islamic jurisprudence. Second, the adjective militant indicates that those who support an Islamist or Salafist ideological position are also engaged in direct action, to use an evocative military term. It may not be necessary to stress the importance of making distinctions when speaking to the distinguished members of the Philadelphia Society, but in general, the tendency among citizens is to simplify and to blend. This is one reason why there was such a great ruckus over the purchase by Dubai Ports World of the Peninsular and Orient Steam Navigation Company, and with it the contract to manage the operations of several port facilities, including that of Philadelphia. In fact, it's highly unlikely that port security would have been imperiled by this corporate acquisition by a cash-rich company headquartered in the United Arab Emirates. But for a lot of Americans, it did not look that way. And in fact, if America cannot do business in the UAE, which is as pro-American a place as exists in the Middle East outside of Israel, it cannot do business anywhere in the Muslim world. So, distinctions matter. For example, some Palestinian and Iraqi terrorist groups are secular militants, and most Salafist or Islamist groups are not militant in the sense of using terrorist direct action at all. Some, including the Shiite Hizb al-Dawah and the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, are allies of the United States. That is, radical Islamists are not necessarily militant Islamists, even if they both use the same or very similar language. Among the militant Islamists, furthermore, some such as Hamas and Hezbollah are pursuing so-called classic national liberation objectives, rather like the Tamil Tigers or the IRA. Others, notably Al-Qaeda, are international or ecumenic, and in between the globalists and the nationalists, there are regional groups. Jamaat Islamiyah comes quickly to mind. Sometimes Islamist militants are referred to as jihadists, though this term is misleading in the same way that national liberation is misleading. With the latter, there was never any question of liberty being involved. With the former, there's nothing sanctified in the war that's being conducted. For so-called jihadists, there is simply armed struggle, including terrorism, against an existing regime. What most are engaged in, properly speaking, is hirabah, unholy war, not jihad. On the other hand, almost no one uses the term, so we're probably stuck with jihadists. And finally, there is the issue of Wahhabism. Not all Wahhabis are militants or jihadists, but most jihadists are Wahhabi. There are exceptions. The first jihadists grew out of the radical but not militant Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, and the Taliban are not Wahhabi at all. The intellectual pedigree of radical Islam, which, as I mentioned, can be traced back to Ibn Taymiyyah and his response to the Mongol destruction of the Abbasid Caliphate in 1258, does not explain how terrorist direct action came to be understood as enacting the will of God. To begin with, it's highly improper on traditional Islamic grounds to identify martyrdom with indiscriminate violence, let alone suicide. How the Islamist militants or Salafist terrorists came to the conclusion that killing the innocent by means of suicide attacks was moral or is evidence of martyrdom is particularly surprising because the Salafists take their name from the al-Salaf al-Salahin, the pious forefathers. We shall see, however, that they have nothing in common with the pious forefathers, or more broadly, with what, in the absence of Muslim orthodoxy, is often referred to as Quranic Islam. I tried to sort out some of these problems in a book published about a year and a half ago called New Political Religions, using several concepts developed by Eric Vogelin. I didn't have the presence of mind to bring copies to sign. I won't make that mistake again, I can assure you. There are, however, order forms outside. And you can also acquire the entire collected works of Eric Vogelin for about $500, I think. It's a University of Missouri publication. Anyway, I will mention only a couple of issues. Two Vogelinian terms, those of you who are familiar with his work. The first is second reality, and the second is pneumopathology. Second reality is the result of a deliberate act of the imagination. Human beings have the capacity to imagine themselves to be subhuman or superhuman, enjoying a direct line to God or to the meaning of history. In contrast to this reality of the imagination is the common experience of being human that in turn is elaborated in several distinct but equivalent symbolizations. As for the second term, literally, a pneumopathology is a spiritual sickness, in contrast to a psychopathology, a psychological disorder. The difference between the two is that psychopaths cannot tell the difference between good and evil, whereas pneumopaths can tell the difference perfectly well and go out of their way to hide what they know, typically by using religious symbols and language to intoxicate themselves into oblivion with respect to what they know. Several years ago, Bruce Hoffman noted that terrorist killers almost always see their purposes as altruistic. In terms that I was using, they can do so by creating a second reality where murder is seen as sacrifice. This moral perversity was present in old-style terrorists, such as the IRA, but was accompanied by some highly rational cost-benefit calculations. They were engaged in chiefly in what in the 19th century was called propaganda by deed. Whereas Brian Jenkins said in 1975, terrorists want a lot of people watching and a lot of people listening and not a lot of people dead. 30 years ago, terrorism was a kind of brutal negotiating technique that calibrated violence more or less in light of an intelligible common sense political objective. This can't be said either for Islamist militants, whether local or transnational. As Jenkins said in 1996, if God tells you to do it, God knows you did it. You don't have to issue a communique. In short, we're not dealing with any form of negotiation. I have a couple of additional points to make. First, underlying Salafist terrorism is a dogmatic narrative of Islamic history that is unfortunately widely shared in the Ummah, the Muslim community. Political science must make another distinction, this time between the history of Islam and Islamic history. The former is similar to the history of gunpowder or the history of the Republican Party of Pennsylvania. In contrast, Islamic history is the story of God and humanity, is a story of successive revelations of God's will for humans through the, quote, monotheistic or, quote, Abrahamic religions. The story starts with the Jews in the Old Testament and continues with the Christians in the New Testament and ends with the revelation of the prophet and the words of the angel Gabriel to Muhammad, which is the text of the Holy Quran. For traditional Muslim believers, this is a simple truth. For scholars of Islam, and especially for political scientists, it's a theological account that has a history similar to that found in Judaism and Christianity. For a traditional Muslim, God told them that Jews and Christians were also Muslims, though they didn't know it yet, but they would someday. Moreover, the early triumphs of the Arab army seemed to confirm God's will. Of course, there were similar experiences in Judaism and Christianity, but there was never any respectable way to account for, quote, what went wrong, when invariably it did. At the end of the 9th century, the philosophically inclined Mu'tazilite school was suppressed, and thereafter one finds only individual philosophical thinkers, Farabi, Avicenna, Averroes, and of course Ibn Khaldun, and no schools, no institutional support. Instead, the response of Ibn Taymiyyah, mentioned earlier, was typical. It combined a strict and dogmatic interpretation of Sharia and vigorous enforcement by the sword. His 13th century jurisprudence was the most important in the present context. The formula was resurrected practically to the letter in the 18th century by Abdul Wahhab and simplified further by the detribalized Wahhabi Muslim Brotherhood in the 19th. By the time one reaches a religious ignoramus such as Sayyid Qutb, bin Laden, or al-Zawahiri, the language is as debased as that used by Nazis and Bolsheviks. In short, for 500 years, the fundamental assumption that law in the Muslim world was holy and thus immutable resulted in the felicitous phrase of Roger Scruton in a confiscation of the political, and that has never been overcome. One might add, the suppression of philosophers resulted in the confiscation of the rational as well. Some of this deculturation is familiar from Western historical experience for the obvious reason that the process of social and political disorder engenders typical human responses. Political, social, or spiritual disorder places in question the received structures and institutions of life that conventionally provide stability and meaning for most of us most of the time. When things fall apart, we're on our own, and usually that means we're lost. In theological language, when God seems to disappear from the world and from life, when God seems to cease supporting his people, human beings characteristically evoke substitutes, second realities, that are symbolized in a language that is typically close to the original and genuinely religious evocation. Here's one example. In traditional or Quranic Islam, a martyr, shahid, bears witness to the truth of Allah, usually by suffering. In the Islamic tradition, determining who is a martyr is a decision taken by the religious leadership with respect to those who die for the sake of the ummah. The process is similar to becoming a saint in the Catholic Church, though the details obviously differ. Suicide, however, is prohibited, indirectly in the Quran and directly in reliable hadiths, the sayings of the Prophet. But one fine day in 1984, for entirely political reasons, Sheikh Mohammed Hussein Fadl Allah invented the doctrine of ijtihad, self-martyrdom, and with it, an imaginary community that can be joined only through death. In addition to substituting their own meaning for well-attested traditional ones, the Islamist militants, particularly the transnational ones in Al-Qaeda, have created their own narrative to explain their actions. This narrative is in conflict with the narratives of the nationalists and, relatively speaking, more pragmatic militants, as well as non-militant Salafists. Initially, al-Zawahiri sought to attack the, quote, near enemy, the so-called apostate regimes of the Middle East, but the experience of the war in Afghanistan convinced him of the necessity of an ecumenic and apocalyptic jihad against the far enemy, first the Soviets, then following the issuing of the famous pseudo-fatwa of 1998 directed against Jews and Crusaders, against America. It's often forgotten that the more pragmatic terrorists with intelligible political agendas were scandalized by the strategy of bin Laden and al-Zawahiri. Their response to this criticism was to become even more abusive, which may remind students of the early Soviet Union of polemics between Stalin and Trotsky. Such acrimony is, in fact, a symptom of a real problem for Islamist militants. The Mujahid, in terms of his own self-understanding, looks over his shoulder and sees nothing but infidels and apostates, kafir, in the very places in the Muslim world that he, by his own lights, is striving to protect. These Mujahideen see themselves as fighting on a frontier to protect a center that has no room for them. They're not protecting any particular piece of territory, but, so to speak, the idea of a non-existent and imaginary ummah. They are besieged in a fortress they do not inhabit, as Olivier Roy said. The symbol of the empty fortress is the perfect expression of the pneumopathological aspect of militant pseudo-jihad. Their spiritual journey is simply to fight, and dying is proof of success. Let me leave you with this conclusion. Terrorist consciousness, which is expressed in the texts that are meant to interpret their acts, is the intelligible expression of a universal human experience. Political disorder in the modern Islamic world has evoked a genuine horror at existence and at the structure of reality. From this experience arises a desire to escape reality or to transform it along the lines of a second reality more congenial to the pneumopathological terrorist imagination. In short, we in the West have encountered such forms of consciousness before in the great ideological movements of the last two centuries, and we shall no doubt see it again after the last member of Al-Qaeda has been killed or retired or converted to Sufi mysticism.